You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, cultural norms around swearing have changed over time, but there are still some places, like on the radio, where you can't curse. We'll talk to a psychologist who studies offensive language to find out how we navigate our F-words and other popular alternatives. Now, the Food and Drug Administration released guidance earlier this month that said non-dairy beverages, like those made out of soy, oat, or coconut, for example, can continue to be labeled as milk. The guidance includes new labeling around nutrition, saying that the nutritional differences between non-dairy and dairy milk products need to be clearly written on the non-dairy products. Well, you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these non-dairy milk-like beverages being labeled as blank milk? Have you changed your drinking habits to more non-dairy beverages instead of dairy beverages? Why or why not? Do you think it's confusing to have the word milk on things that don't come from animals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. I talked to Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin earlier this afternoon. She released new legislation on this issue today. Senator Baldwin, welcome back to the show.
It's great to join you.
Let's start with these new FDA guidelines saying, in effect, yeah, keep labeling this vegetable stuff as milk, but maybe put some nutritional labels on it. What do you think of that kind of splitting the hairs there idea?
Yeah, I really feel like the FDA has let us down. Dairy farmers in Wisconsin and across the country produce second to none products with the highest nutritional value. And these imitation dairy products have gotten away with, I guess, profiting by using dairy's good name without meeting the nutritional standards that our dairy farmers work so hard to meet.
Now, you've got this Dairy Pride Act dropping it, the new version of it today, some bipartisan support on this. What would it do?
You know, it is strongly bipartisan. I'm very proud to have worked with members of both parties to put this legislation together and sort of stand up to these imitation products. Our Dairy Pride Act will protect our dairy farmers and ensure that consumers understand and know the nutritional value of what they're purchasing, and they won't be misled by these imitation products into thinking that something else called milk that's made from a plant or a nut is the same thing as the milk that we produce across the United States on dairy farms.
Do you see the FDA's announcement here as consistent with law as it stands and guidelines as they stand now?
No, I'm very disappointed by the Food and Drug Administration's actions and guidance in this regard. The FDA has basically standards of identity that define what milk is, what yogurt is, what other dairy products are. And to allow these imitations to use the term milk or yogurt or cheese when they're not is just, I think, against their own obligations.
Are you selling consumers a little short here when we look and see the word almond above milk? We know that it's not from a cow, right? We know that it's something different than dairy. Do we consumers really need this kind of law?
Yeah. You know, nobody's saying that plant-based substitutes should not be allowed to be sold or enjoyed by people who prefer them. But they don't have to use the word milk. It could be almond beverage, or, you know, I could suggest any number of ways of describing what it is. But the term milk suggests a nutrient quality that our farmers work really hard to meet. And these products shouldn't just be able to use them and really suggest some sort of nutritional equivalency that just doesn't exist.
Now, if I were a maker of, almond beverage, I'm not. But if I were, I might say, okay, we've got peanut butter. People know it's not dairy butter, but, you know, it's got that consistency. It's got that function. Maybe philosophically, we could say the same thing about milk. It isn't the nutritional value. It's the function, the texture, that sort of thing. So why can't I call my almond beverage almond milk?
again, there's nobody suggesting that they don't market these products, and there's nothing suggesting that consumers who, through their own study or of what nutrient qualities these beverages have, shouldn't be able to consume them. But there is a very misleading factor when you call it milk or cheese or cream when it's not.
What is the timeline for this legislation?
Well, it's, first of all, wonderful to introduce it today and have support from, frankly, colleagues across the country and of both parties. We are working on a number of pieces of legislation this year that have to do with agriculture. The Farm Bill will be reauthorized later this year. There's also an annual agricultural appropriations process. These are many opportunities for us to highlight the issue and try to incorporate the Dairy Pride Act into one of these bills.
And as we wrap up, Senator Baldwin, what's at stake for a dairy farmer in Wisconsin?
Well, these last few years have been super tough on our dairy farmers, especially those who are operating small or medium-sized family farms. They've been challenged by trade disputes. They've been challenged by extreme weather event. They've been challenged by widely fluctuating costs for inputs like feed. And in most cases, they do not control what the market will pay for the product they produce. Yet they work 24/7, 365 days a year to meet these FDA standards. And so there's a lot at stake in this measure to make sure that imitation products don't get to profit off of the hard work that dairy farms and dairy farmers commit to making some of the greatest products around, namely our milk and cream and cheese, et cetera.
Senator Baldwin, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
That was Senator Tammy Baldwin talking about dairy milk and non-dairy alternatives, whether they should be labeled as milk, you know, the things labeled soy milk, almond milk, oat milk at your grocery store. I talked to her earlier today. You could join in with your thoughts on the issue at 800-642-1234. Do we need a law like that? 800-642-1234. Pam Yonke joins us now. Pam's the farm director for the Midwest Farm Report Radio Network. Pam, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob, good to be with you.
You have been following the response from the dairy industry in Wisconsin to those FDA guidelines. What kind of things are you hearing?
Well, I think a lot of what the senator has already brought up. My job is obviously to reflect what the industry is talking about. Plus, I'm a dairy kid myself. I grew up on a dairy farm. And I think the number one thing is, why isn't FDA enforcing the guidelines that are already in place? That was the first argument that the dairy industry made a long time ago. And FDA now has kind of thrown their arms up in the air and said, hey, this has been going on so long. Consumers already are putting milk in that conversation. We can't stop that now. That's why the dairy industry is taking issue with that, kind of giving up, so to speak. And the other thing is, and this is one item that I actually kind of learned and want the audience to understand, dairy is a common industry. Milk production goes on across the United States. We have guidelines as far as quality and production standards that have to be met, but it's all called milk. What you may not realize is dairy farmers across the United States put money into what we call a checkoff pool, and that money is to be used for research, promotion, and education of dairy products, milk, cheese, yogurt, etc. According to USDA guidelines and by law, the dairy industry cannot speak or advertise disparaging messages about another product. Now, flip that and understand that the plant-based beverages we're talking about are privately funded. They are companies. They are enterprises that are not under the same dictates as our dairy farmers are. So what I'm getting at here is, when you see all the splashy commercials, promotions, colors, mascots, whatever you want to call it, all the marketing, that is private money. That's investor money. Those are businesses. Those are, you know, Wall Street. Our dairy farmers cannot do that by law. So it's a really interesting situation when you start looking at that pure and simple disadvantage that dairy is at when it comes to the plant-based beverages. And as the senator aptly pointed out, the other thing is just quite frankly, how many people are going to take time to read the nutritional guidelines and the nutritional breakouts that FDA says they are going to require plant-based beverages to put on their products? I don't know about you, Rob, but the last time that I was in the grocery store, I really wasn't afforded a lot of time to, and at my age, pull out the cheaters or the magnifying glass to read that kind of information, even if I could get my arms around it and understood what it was telling me. So like I said, I think that the dairy industry is just exceptionally frustrated that the infrastructure that was set up for them to be guided by as far as production standards, for the dairy industry to be guided by as far as manufacturing standards, for food safety to be guided by as far as ways to protect consumers, are suddenly just being cast aside saying, okay, everybody in the pool, we're all going to try to get along.
We're talking to Pam Jahnke, farm director for the Midwest Farm Report Radio Network, about newly released guidelines by the FDA. They allow for non-dairy milk alternatives to continue having the M-word, milk, on them, the oat milks, soy milks, and other beverages of the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that's okay? Do you disagree with that decision? Do you want, as Senator Tammy Baldwin told us earlier, a law saying if it says milk, it's got to be from a cow or other mammal that we commonly drink the milk of? If you're a dairy farmer, love to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll start taking your calls coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Pam Jahnke, Farm Director for the Midwest Farm Report Radio Network, about FDA guidelines on labeling non-dairy milk alternatives as milk, the soy milks, oat milks, and more of the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the word milk be on products, beverages that don't come from a cow or other mammal? 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls now. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, hello. Gwen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
The dogs are excited to be on the air, too. That's awesome. Go ahead, Gwen.
Yeah, I don't believe that products that are not from a mammal should be called milk, because there is confusion in some cases. You know, you read periodically about very well-meaning parents trying to be vegan with their children and a child dying because of ignorance, because they didn't get the nourishment that they needed. And I think that by labeling these other products as milk, we're causing confusion for people who love their children, want their children, are thinking that they're doing the best for their children, but are being misled.
Gwen, thanks for the call. Pam, this is an issue I think that comes up fairly often in this conversation.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the thing is, she's not wrong. There was a national survey that was done by one of our Wisconsin cooperatives, and really it did find out, truthfully, consumers are confused. They just do not understand what those imitation products mean to them. And it's not just about milk. It's also when you see the phrase cheese, they automatically assume that there is, that it's got protein. And some people even believe that the plant-based products have a higher quality of protein and nutrition than dairy does. What you have to realize is, in, for example, plant-based cheese, there is zero or very little protein at all. So the information being presented is obviously one way to combat some of that. But to my point previously, how many people really have the time, take the time, or if they read that, would even fully understand what the nutrition information means to them or their family? So I do, as much as I wish our consumers knew everything about what we do in agriculture, how we produce, what we produce for them, I wish they had a better connectedness to that. Unfortunately, the numbers just don't play out that way.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Michael now in Milwaukee. Michael, hello.
Hey, so growing up in Wisconsin, the dairy state, I understand the desire to protect and empower Wisconsin dairy farmers, and I can appreciate it. But I have to, you know, kind of roll my eyes at the debate over the semantics of this. Is this really where the energy is best spent, is to fight over, okay, what are we calling what? Is this going to end up, even with a law passing, kind of like Band-Aids and Kleenex, where we use a brand name or a name that's already so ingrained in our vernacular that, okay, you've outlawed how they can label it, but people are so used to calling it that nothing's really going to change.
Michael, thanks for the call. So we might, even if the labels don't say oat milk anymore, we might still call it oat milk. So does anything really change, Pam?
You know, and he brings up a good point. I think you're right. And that's part of the reason why FDA said, hey, we're going to allow them to use the phrase, because people have already become so accustomed to this. I think the dairy industry's point is that they have the ability to change their name. They have their ability, and some companies have. I've noticed myself, because obviously I pay attention, some have come up with alternative names, and that's part of their branding. They need to differentiate why their almond milk is better than oat milk. So there's even fighting within this thin segment. Well, they can pivot. They can change their logo. They can change their name. They can change what they call themselves. They're not under the dictates that dairy producers are. So I think he's right. There are going to be consumers that say, hey, I buy that pink package. I buy that blue package. I buy that brown package with the cow head on it. That's the way they'll buy. For others that are truly curious about the nutritional value, that are genuinely, you know, trying to get some of those answers, they deserve to be pointed in the right direction to try to find some of that. And like I said, I think our dairy farmers just feel betrayed after the years and years and millions of dollars they've spent in building up the good reputation that milk as a phrase brings to consumers. They just flat out feel betrayed.
Thanks for the call, Michael. Talking to Pam Jahnke, a famous radio farm reporter here in Wisconsin, looking at the debate over whether non-dairy alternative beverages can have the word milk on them, soy milk, oat milk, and more. Back to your calls now with Bob in Madison. Bob, hi.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the discussion. I am all for giving up using the word milk for vegetable-based beverages, as long as the dairy industry is willing to give up calling cheese labeled as Gruyere, Gouda, Parmesan, that is manufactured in Wisconsin.
Bob, thanks for the call. This is a big trade issue, I think, more than anything, Pam. Can you call a Swiss-style cheese made in Wisconsin Swiss cheese? And the list goes on and on.
Sure. Yeah. And I appreciate his point. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. I get that. But to your point, again, those phrases for decades have pointed out a type of cheese that you're buying that is produced in Wisconsin. Are they producing Colby cheese someplace other than Wisconsin? I mean, like you said, you can get in deep water pretty quick. And to his point, again, we can rename those cheeses if we wanted to. It becomes a part of a whole new tasting opportunity in grocery stores. And I almost think in that regard that then consumers just get frustrated at, like he said, when are you going to quit fighting over these things? Milk is a generic name. It is just that. A generic name, by definition, comes from a mammal. So that's where the line in the sand is as far as the dairy industry is concerned. And to your point, Rob, yeah, that turns into a little bit more of a trade-related battle than it does consumer confusion.
Bob, thanks for the call. Tina Maria is with us now, calling from the Milwaukee area. Tina Maria, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I think that we've been calling coconut milk and coconut cream and milk for many, many years. And, you know, to change this is just a really ridiculous argument. If anything should change, it should be calling dairy milk dairy, because we already call goat milk goat milk. And it's just a really silly argument. And I understand they want to protect their industry, but I see nothing wrong with oat milk, dairy, cow milk, if they want to keep it.
I gotcha. Tina Maria, thanks for the call. Pam, what do you think? I think some people look at this and say, it's just a word.
Sure. Oh, I can absolutely understand that and appreciate it, too. I think part of it is because in Wisconsin, we are very entrenched in the dairy industry as a whole. Like I said, I speak of this not just because this is my profession, but because it's my passion. It's my background. So I completely understand the outside perspective on that. And as she points out, and aptly so, if we go down this, rat hole of constant conversation, and you can imagine the confusion there may already be with elected officials in Washington, D.C., despite Senator Baldwin's best efforts, maybe that is the next caveat that the dairy industry looks at. But again, that is a very expensive pivot for an industry that's all about just providing quality goods and continuing to provide quality goods to have to make as far as labeling is concerned. And would it add an extra phase of confusion on to that consumer? So I do think that this is debate and discussion that's going to continue. It has been going on for a while already, Rob, as you are well aware. And I am not so naive as to believe that we are going to solve it overnight, despite the legislation that the senator introduced today. And as I said, the one thing I want consumers to realize is the limitations the dairy industry has as far as addressing this issue. No name calling, because we contribute to promotion of milk as a mammal beverage. So no name calling, and the flexibility that those industries of plant-based beverages have to change up their marketing style, to change up their displays, etc. And they have much more money to draw from than the dairy industry does. So it is going to be an interesting dynamic to watch play out. And like I said, I think the bottom line is the dairy industry just wishes that the Food and Drug Administration would take their job, their responsibilities, and the laws they already have on the books a little bit more seriously.
Pam, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure, Rob. Anytime.
That's Pam Yonke, Farm Director for the Midwest Farm Report Radio Network. She joined us today to talk about FDA guidelines on non-dairy milk alternatives and objections to them being labeled with the word milk. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tomorrow on the morning show, a big Supreme Court case on what we see on the internet, who's liable for the wrong stuff on the internet. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we heard from the author of the new book, 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die, and you joined in with your recommendations, lots of them. And we heard from some more of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan wrote, on my bucket list, the halfway point between the equator and the North Pole and the prime meridian and the international dateline. Now, Joel responded, a halfway point to the North Pole marker is on Highway 141, just north of Pound. Well, that's halfway there. I poked around on the internet. There's a marker for Ryan's more specific point. In western Marathon County, you can find the place where 45 degrees north and 90 degrees west cross each other. That's by Athens, where I had some great pizza at a WPR event last summer. And David wrote, Yerkes Observatory, always wanted to see it, never have. That is in the book. I'm in the same boat, David. That's in Williams Bay. A couple fun facts. This is a big deal observatory back in the day. There were researchers like Edwin Hubble, like the guy the Hubble telescope was named after, and a fellow named Carl Sagan researched there as well. Cool Wisconsin news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Our broadcast license from the FCC doesn't allow us to curse on the radio, but swearing is more acceptable in some workplaces and walks of life than others. You might not want to swear at your boss, but it might be less of a big deal if you drop the occasional profanity around a trusted coworker. Cursing has long been viewed as unprofessional or inappropriate, but it seems to be becoming more commonplace in other environments as social and cultural norms have changed. We're talking about swearing now with one of the world's leading experts on our so-called naughty and taboo words. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have your views or practices on swearing changed over time? Do you swear now more than you used to? Do you notice other people swearing more? Where and when? What contexts and places are appropriate, or is there no right time or place? Call in. keep it clean at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Timothy Jay is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He's the author of 6 books on cursing, language, and inappropriate behavior. He's a widely cited expert on swearing. His book titles include Why We Curse and We Did What? Timothy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, I'm darn glad to be here.
Now, what is it? You've done a lot of work on swearing and cursing. What is it about swearing that, as a psychologist, you find so interesting?
Well, it's the speakable taboo. We're not supposed to do it, but everybody knows how to swear, and children know how to swear. So it's the one kind of language you learn very early on, but you're not allowed to use it. And I think it's the taboo nature of it. It's that, you know, that the edge of proper language, and you're like, where is that line? Where is it appropriate? What does it tell us about people and how they interact? How are cultures different? How does the brain mature to do this? There's so many questions that are interesting to me as a scientist that every time I found the answer to one question, a dozen more would pop up. That's why it's interesting to me.
Now, there's a handful of common words that might pop to mind when we think of cursing and swearing. What is it that leads a word to be promoted or demoted, however you want to think of it, to one of those words?
Well, it's all convention. These are all standards that have evolved over centuries, and they have mainly to do with religion, sexuality, relationships with ancestors, animal names, and sort of disgusting things that come out of your body. Those cover even globally the categories of words that become taboo. And the English speaking countries, these words have been fairly stable for years. The 4-letter words, these are 1,000 years old. So these are conventions or standards that are passed on from generation to generation, and they're policed by what I call the institutions of power, like religion, education, mass media all have standards. And the fact that these institutions of power punish people or reprimand people for using these language makes them remain powerful.
We're talking to Timothy Jay, psychologist expert on swearing and taboo language. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the use of profane language. Do you see more of it than you used to? Where is it appropriate? Is it ever appropriate? What do you think? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to talk about context in which we use these words, Timothy. In my job on the radio, if I use certain words, I'm subjecting our station to potentially very big fines and me getting fired. If I use a profanity, say, at band practice, I might be, I don't know, building solidarity with the guys. Can you talk about the importance of context in determining when and where we say these words?
Yeah, that's the examples you gave are good. Context is the end all and the be all of using this kind of language. What a word means, how offensive it is, depends entirely on context, the who, what, where, and when. And as these variables shift, whether language is appropriate, offensive language is appropriate or not, it also shifts.
We are taking your calls at 800-642-1234 on swearing and cursing, keeping it clean, of course. And speaking of keeping it clean, we've got, you used the darn earlier, the shoot, the fudge.
Yes.
They feel a little silly sometimes. They don't seem to express exactly the same emotions. Why is that?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure that they do. These are euphemisms, so they're sort of cover words. They're used a lot by Mormons. I've worked with a study on how Mormons use these instead of the more potent four-letter words. so they kind of stand in. I think people probably they relate to or connect with the underlying obscenities with these words when they're substituted, but they allow us or the speakers who use them to vent or express emotions in a more polite way. I think that's the value of using these. That's why I said darn in the beginning. I could have said damn, that's acceptable. Yep. in media. But it wasn't 100 years ago with the power of the church. 100 years ago, you couldn't say things like that on the radio or in the early film industry. So with the decline of the power of the church in America, these what are technically profanities that are religious references have lost their power. And so we find them, like the euphemisms, are used frequently now, not 100 years ago, but the OMG, we hear that. And I hear a lot of people say, oh my God. I hear more women say that than men. I hear more children say that. I don't know. I play golf and hockey. I don't hear my teammates saying, oh my God, they usually use saltier four-letter words. But I think that's the value of these euphemisms in their time and place. They're more appropriate.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Morgan is with us in Eau Claire. Morgan, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for this. It really caught my attention just because I have a 5-year-old and she loves to express herself. I will, you know, occasionally say, you know, the 4-letter swear word, but like more like in excitement or just more to express myself. And I've noticed just as she gets older, she'll say it kind of just more casually than maybe some people would be comfortable with. So I guess just my question was, do you feel like that is something that is okay for her to be able to express? Or I guess I'm not sure what the line is between it being appropriate or being not appropriate.
Morgan, thanks. You're talking to a guy who wrote a book called What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty. What would you tell her, Timothy?
Yeah, I every parent should anticipate this. By the time the kids go off to school, they probably have a vocabulary of about 40 different words that they've learned from their listening to their parents and to their friends. They might use these kind of words more with their friends than around their parents. But I think that's a great occasion for you, Meredith, to express your family values. And I think the best thing is to remain cool. You know, don't overreact. That only makes the words more powerful and gives the kids the, I can push mom's buttons with these words. Remain cool. Ask them about their emotions. You know, like, why are you using this word? Are you angry? You know, you can also just say, I'm angry. But I think you want to keep the door open as a mother to talk about not only words, but also what's going to happen in a few years is the sexual terms will come in. And you don't want to be repressive about that. You know, you want to be, if you want to communicate your values about religion or sexuality, I think that's your role as a parent. So anticipate it, be cool about it. But if you have rules about this, then if the kid breaks the rule, then there are consequences. So I think it's an integral part of parenting. But what surprised me in the psychological literature, especially developmental psychology, there was no mention of this in scientific literature. That's why one of the reasons why I wrote the book, What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty, is every parent knows this is important. And also, besides the 4-letter words, it's like, how do I talk about my body? How do I talk about the things that come out of my body? You know, how does my family talk about these things? So take that as a role as a parent and as an educator to teach values to your daughter.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to psychologist Timothy Jay with the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts about cursing and the cultural norms around naughty words. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about swearing? Do you think people should let loose and say what they want? When, where, what environment is the right time to swear, if any? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, hear from some more of you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Timothy Jay, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, author of many books on the subject of cursing and swearing. He's with us today to talk about why we swear, how different social environments affect the language we use. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in the Beloit area. Bob, hello.
Why, hello. So I just wanted to bring this up. My mom is going to be 101 in March, still living at home, and she started a cussing club probably when she was in her 80s. And her theory behind it was to bring all the friends and people over. They could come in, they could cuss, they could get everything out of their system. And she kind of thought that people, when they got older with dementia, then wouldn't be doing that as much because they felt free to get that out at this point. I just thought that was a interesting vision, and there's no scientific evidence behind it, obviously, but I'm curious about what your speaker's thoughts are on that.
Well, and Bob, I got to ask, have you been to one of these, or were you not invited as you know, a kid, not one of the peers?
I was not invited. This was something my mom did with her a bunch of her lady friends, and primarily started because one of her friends was getting dementia and was starting to cuss and use some of those languages, And this made her feel more comfortable, bringing her in and doing social functions when everybody could come in and just
Bob, that is super interesting. Thanks for sharing that. Timothy, I'm gonna guess there may not be a lot of research on this, but what do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think it's also part of what we're seeing now, more women swearing generally as more women are in the workplace, more women in public. Sort of a more empowerment of women to use this, what I would call powerful language. Certainly, if you're going to work in a high pressure context like a law firm, the women in the law firm are going to pick this up. But with regard to aging, although I can never imagine my mother doing this, I was raised in a very religious family. I never heard my mother swear, although my father was a bricklayer, and I heard him swear, especially at work. But we have studied cursing in nursing homes, and what he reported is happening. What is happening is there in a nursing home, you have sort of, with dementia, you have a reversion to childhood, and people with dementia become very childlike. They're not as careful about their bath habits, and they revert to the emotional language of childhood. If the person is bilingual, they usually will revert to swearing in their native language. But this is common in nursing home settings, especially in the dementia wings. And where you will see them using the language of their childhood. So what we recorded about 20 years ago in the nursing homes was we didn't have the offensive language that teenagers use now. It was mainly profanity, words like Jesus, damn, goddamn, words like that. It will be interesting to see when the younger generation reaches the nursing home and has dementia, I would imagine the kind of language we'll hear in another 40 or 50 years is going to be a lot worse now. But the use of profanity during dementia is common along with other sort of childlike behavior.
Bob, thanks for sharing that story. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I'm under the impression that a lot of swear words covering taboo subjects, the culture, whatever the culture it is that's using those words, they tend to borrow the words from other cultures, somehow for one's own culture, it's demeaning to use words to cover perhaps sexual subjects, and so you borrow words from other cultures.
Tom, interesting. Thanks. Timothy, is that something that we use loan words for some of these ideas?
Well, I think of the lexicon of swearing like a garden, and there are some plants in there that are ancient, and like the F word and the S word, those words have been around for a thousand. They grew up in Anglo-Saxon culture, but also influenced by German and Italian. So there is some borrowing. Where I see that obviously today is the expansion of hip hop culture around the world globally, where you have people that are saying American swear words that they pick up in hip hop from music and other genres of hip hop. And they, you know, it's common to hear this in Sweden or Germany or Switzerland, to hear swear words being appropriated. This is happening now more than ever because of the global expansion of entertainment media and film and music, but also the internet. But again, if you get a new word, a new plant, an exotic in your garden, and it doesn't resonate with the speakers of that culture, then it will disappear. And that's very common for slang. For slang terms, I can think of the slang of the 60s when I was growing up. Nobody would use that kind of language now. But we're now having cross-cultural conferences on offensive language, which would have never happened 50 years ago.
Tom, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Interesting point. Talking to Timothy Jay, psychologist, expert on swearing. Back to your calls. Adam was with us in River Falls. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Yeah, interesting topic. Growing up on a farm, there was lots of cursing down in the barn when things did not go well, but my mom made sure we did not use those words in the house. So my question is, how much control do we have over these words? And as I'm raising little boys now, and you mentioned kids earlier on. Are there any tactics in helping make sure that those words don't come up or aren't used as much as they can be?
Well, I think on that last note, I think you should expect them to come up. Every competent speaker of English knows all these swear words. I think what you need to engage them is in a discussion of etiquette. Language has styles, like clothing has styles, and where you learn where it's appropriate and where it's not appropriate. I had the same kind of division of labor in my house where what happened at work was different than what happened at the dinner table. And I think by the time boys are adolescents, they need to learn that what you can say in the backyard, what you can say in the barn, is different than what you can say at work or at school. That's just part of, you know, learning your culture. But expect them to learn this. And also, problematic is talking about sexuality with your parents is also difficult. So, I think I would anticipate this. I've worked in dozens of different contexts. I worked in a factory. I worked with my father, who was a bricklayer. And the language shifted in all these places. When I, as a professor for 40 years, I rarely used this language in the classroom unless I was angry. And I think, again, like raising your children is helping them learn to express their emotions. And I think sometimes, like when things go wrong anywhere in the barn or on the golf course or at work, and we become frustrated, it seemed to be there's sort of a natural reflexive use of this, like the hammer on the thumb idea. So that kind of stuff, I think, is a habit which is kind of drilled into you, or that you've practiced enough that it becomes almost automatic. Whereas other times, I think answering the question about control is a matter of, should I use this kind of language or tell this kind of joke in this situation? And there's where it's not like the hammer on the thumb. It's more like what I call strategic use of this. Like, that's not a good idea to say that here. Or maybe I should say that here because I'm angry.
Adam, thanks for that call. And Timothy, thanks again for joining us today.
As I said, I'm darn glad to be here and tell your listeners to support public radio. I do.
Thank you so much. That's Timothy Jay, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, author of a number of books on cursing, language, and inappropriate behavior. He's with us today to talk about why people curse and swear and how the cultural norms around those taboo words can change over time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today on a challenge to the Biden administration's student loan debt forgiveness plan. We'll check out the legal challenge and what's at stake. Plus, former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold joins the show for a look at judges and the string of judicial appointments since President Biden came into office. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, more companies are experimenting with a four-day work week. A Wisconsin business professor joins the show for a look at the advantages and the drawbacks of the change. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.